for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jakar Sanayev is hospitalized and in custody 1 week after the explosions which killed three and wounded nearly 180 at the Boston Marathon. The city will mark the traumatic week with a moment of silence. Here in the studio to talk about the latest in the investigation, as well as the legal, political, and security ramifications, Devlin Barrett of The Wall Street Journal, Kirsten Todd of Liberty Group Ventures, David Cole of Georgetown University Law Center, and Tom Gelton of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Devlin Barrett, I'll start with you. What's the latest on Jakar Tsarnaev's medical condition?
Our understanding is that as of last night, he was still in and out of consciousness, and in recent hours, he has begun answering some very basic questions in writing. He can't speak, or he can't speak clearly because he's been shot in the throat, is our understanding. And so they're doing some what's been described to me as basic written communications, but it's not clear yet how much into the meat of the matter they've gotten. All I've been told is that there is still no reason to believe that there are other devices or other would-be bombers connected to this loose in the city or anywhere else.
Do we have any idea how this injury to the throat occurred? Was it a possible suicide attempt?
It's been described to me as a possibility, but the same folks caution that there were so many bullets flying around in both of these confrontations that's strictly a theory at this point that is a possibility.
Tom Gelton, what do we know about any other attacks that these two brothers may have been planning?
I don't think we know. We certainly don't know what targets they may have had in mind or what plans they had. What we know, which is pretty incriminating in this sense, is that they had a number of explosives in addition to the ones, obviously, that they used at the marathon. They had several in their car or in the younger brother's car on Thursday night when they were involved in this altercation with the police. So presumably they were intending to use those bombs somewhere else. And of course, the police found yet another bomb back in their apartment. So they had a number of other explosives. They had them in the car with them that night in one of the cars. So clearly they had something else in mind, but I don't think we know yet what they were planning to do.
One other aspect I've been really confused about. It's been said that the younger brother ran over his older brother.
Right.
Can you explain what happened, or at least what we know?
Well, there were two cars. Each of them had a car, and they had carjacked a Mercedes, plus the younger brother had his own car, which was a Honda. When they were in the car chase, they were confronted by police. And they stopped, got out of their car, both of them got out of their car, exchanged fire with the police. And what we have heard from local police authorities is that the older brother, Tamerlan, actually discharged all of his ammunition, ran out of ammunition, at which point he actually literally charged the police. They tackled him. He had already been shot, apparently, but they tackled him. He's on the ground, at which point the younger brother gets in the Mercedes and tries to race out of there, but he throws it into reverse and he's trying to back out of there. And in the chaos and the darkness and the confusion, he runs over his brother.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Just horrible. What are his legal rights, David Cole?
Well, he's a suspect in a criminal investigation. He's been arrested. He was arrested without a warrant. ordinarily, you are required within 48 hours of an arrest to bring the individual before a judge and state what the basis is for the charge. I've heard some suggestions that they're going to bring a judge to the hospital to do that for him. But that's one. And then secondly, if he's interrogated, he has the right to counsel and he has the right to remain silent. There may be some, the government has suggested that it might seek to interrogate him without telling him his rights initially under the public safety exception. But all that is remains to be seen at this point.
How much leeway does the government have in terms of not reading him his Miranda rights?
Well, if the government doesn't want to use his statements against him in a criminal trial, they can question him without Miranda irregardless. The only consequence of questioning without Miranda is that you can't use the statements in a criminal trial. But if they feel like they have sufficient evidence to convict him anyway, then they could go ahead and they think the intelligence they might get from questioning is more important. They could go ahead and sort of say, we're not going to rely on this evidence in the criminal trial, at least. And the only, again, it's not just that you can't use it in the criminal trial. You can't use it in the prosecution's case in chief in the criminal trial. So once the defendant decides to defend himself or take the stand, then all that evidence can come in as impeachment on the prosecution's rebuttal. So there's minimal consequences in some sense. If you have a very strong case against an individual, minimal consequences to not providing him with Miranda warnings.
Declan.
Yeah, that's all right. And by way of comparison, the underwear bomber case is actually very instructive on this point because that's where a lot of these procedures were sort of refined and made clear. And in that case, you had a suspect, again, who was badly injured, who needed medical attention, but who also needed to be interviewed as quickly as possible to find out if there were other bombs coming. And basically, the agents were able to speak to him for about 50 minutes. They got a lot of useful information out of him in that time, and then he went into surgery. When he came out of surgery, he was Mirandized, and he refused to talk any further. Those statements were eventually ruled admissible, but they also had so much evidence against him already that it really didn't matter from the federal prosecutor's point of view for the purpose of prosecuting him whether they could use those statements or not. They were more important for intelligence value to figure out who was behind it and what else they had to worry about.
Kirsten Tutt.
One of the things we're hearing a lot about this morning is the challenge between having him as an enemy combatant or looking at this under the public safety exception. And the issue right now that we're dealing with is that with a public safety exception, we're concerned that he won't talk once he's Mirandized. But looking at his case, it is in his best interest to cooperate because there is a preponderance of evidence against him, all the way from the pressure cooker that they threw out of the window of the car, which is identical to those that they're finding, that they found at the scene, and other evidence that is very strong against him. So it's not that there is a case that can't be made. So it is in his best interest to cooperate, which goes to more of a leniency toward why we would use the public safety exception in this
David
case.
David Cole.
Well, actually, I mean, I agree that it's in his interest to cooperate, but that's an argument for giving him a lawyer. Because what we find often is that when a defendant in a terrorism case sees that he's got a very, very strong case against him and has a lawyer who is advising him, that lawyer will advise him, look, the best thing you can do is try to get some leniency by cooperating. And by having somebody who is aligned with him, giving him that advice, the government has found that they get great cooperation with lawyers. In fact, David Criss, who was the head of the National Security Division in the criminal in the Justice Department, made exactly that argument that we do better when these people are counseled than when they're denied counsel.
Tom Gelton.
Well, I think that David makes a very good case. there, the other argument, which Lindsey Graham has made, is that after all these years of interrogation experience that we've had over the last 10 years, that U.S. government now has really kind of refined the interrogation exercise to the point that they know how to establish rapport with the person they're interrogating, and they're, you know, become very sophisticated about interrogating subjects, and it all depends on the relationship that is established between the interrogator and the subject. And they make the argument that having a lawyer sort of present in that relationship can make it harder to establish the kind of rapport with the subject that you need in order to get the best intelligence. That's the argument that the advocates of this alternative approach are making.
And both Lindsey Graham and John McCain, in addition to saying that perhaps Jokhar should be held as a military and enemy combatant, is that they believe the FBI did not do its job, Tom.
Yeah, this is an issue that we've seen over and over again in the last 10 years, and it goes to that, you know, question of hindsight. There have been many cases where you can see that somebody did not connect the dot or drop the ball or something, but, you know, on the other hand, it's easier to see those in hindsight than it is to put yourself in the shoes of the agencies that have to prioritize their efforts, have to spend their resources where they think the greatest threat is, and it may not be obvious to them where those priorities lie in the moment.
Tom Jelton of NPR. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the older brother's trip to Russia, what we know about what the FBI knew, what the Russians knew, and what the FBI did not know. And welcome back. There are many issues concerned with the Boston bombing. For example, how will Boston bombings affect the Syria debate, the immigration debate? Right now, the question is, when the older brother went back to Russia, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that his mother was indeed playing a part in making him feel more religious and turning away from the use of alcohol, the use of drugs. But something else must have gone on while he was in Russia. And I'm really interested in what you all think about the FBI's role in this. Kirsten.
Well, I think one of the things that this issue is bringing up is how we handle countering violent extremism, which now has an acronym of CVE. The president issued a strategy back in August of 2011, which looked at what we can do as a country to counter violent extremism. And it talks about empowering communities to identify radical behavior and things like that. But what it also talks about are international partnerships. And when it lists the countries that we have those relationships with, they're Western European countries, Australia, Canada. But what this situation really calls into question is how do we have those type of relationships, the CVE relationships, with countries that we don't agree with on everything? And so when we're looking at Russia, it's important to figure out how do we create that bilateral relationship for CVE on issues that align with intelligence gathering, and in a way that also doesn't support or encourage what we disagree with and how Russia defines terrorism and their domestic issues. And I think this will be the new debate on CVE, because there are countries that we need to be working with whom we don't agree on many other issues. And so how do we create those relationships in that bilateral arrangement?
Devlin.
And all those points are exactly right. And you also have to think about the broader relationship between Russia and the U.S. specifically, and the broader relationship between Russian intelligence services and the U.S. intelligence services specifically, meaning the FBI in this instance. These are not organizations that are best of friends necessarily.
But they did communicate to a certain extent.
And they communicate to a certain extent, and they shared worries to a certain extent. And at some point, as best we can tell, both sides decided that this was a guy they didn't need to look at any further. Because remember, the concerns about him are expressed in 2011. He makes the travel back to Russia in 2012, and there's nothing to indicate at this point that Russian intelligence services tracked him or monitored him at all. That may change, but that's what we know right now.
Tom.
You know, one thing that we do not know is what specifically the Russians had learned about him or suspected that prompted this request for information from the FBI. Because at the point that the Russians made that request in 2011, he had not yet gone back to Russia. So they presumably had some line on what he was doing in the U.S. at the time. Now, how do the Russians know what Tamerlan is doing in the U.S.? It seems to me about the only thing that they could have had access to at that point would be his internet online connection, perhaps, with extremist groups in Russia. They may have been alerted to that. But it wasn't as though he had been in Russia doing anything that prompted the Russian intelligence service to get concerned about him.
There are initial preliminary investigative reports that are saying that they identified Tamerlan meeting with a militant Islamic underground individual at a mosque, and that there are 6 meetings in the time while he was in Russia last year. And when they went to pursue and identify that individual and then went to find Tamerlan, they had both disappeared. We're also hearing that there was a report from the FSB that came to the FBI, a file on a case with Tamerlan last November. And what Russia's reporting is that they didn't hear a response from the FBI. We have to be careful not to speculate too much, because this can turn into a he said, she said. And as Devlin made the point earlier, there is a cooperation, but there's a little bit of a love-hate relationship between the two. Nonetheless, these are important, I think, events and data that we need to be looking at as we understand what exactly Tamerlan was doing when he was in Russia.
Does it appear that the relationship between the older brother and the younger brother changed after the older brother returned to the States, Devlin?
I think what's interesting about the relationship is you talk to people who knew the younger brother, Jahar, best, and they seem to have virtually no perception whatsoever of the older brother. As best we can tell so far, the younger brother seems to have had a social life with his friends in college and in high school and that stuff that had no bearing or no interaction with his older brother, but he clearly had a significant relationship with his older brother that did not translate. It makes me wonder, as a reporter, if he essentially had two very different parts of his life, and that he was one person with one group of people and another person within his family structure.
You know, Diane, there's something interesting here. For many years, we've been less affected by Islamist militancy in this country than in Europe. And the explanation has always been that Muslims in this country are much more integrated into American life than Muslims are in the UK or in France or in Germany. And that's why they've, you know, had more, they've dealt more with radicalism in those countries than we have in this country. You know, one of the troubling things I think about this case is it suggests that maybe that is that era over, you know? Can we no longer sort of be comfortable with the extent to which people are integrated into American life, and this idea that sort of being integrated into American life has a kind of moderating, liberalizing effect on you? I mean, that's because Jahar in particular seemed to be as integrated into American society as an outsider could possibly be.
Here is an email from Jack, who says, I'm often amazed at how these public conversations are parsed. It's time to look at the systemic problems we have in our increasingly global culture. Spin it how you will. Now we have seen a 24-hour martial law declared in a major U.S. city, further limiting freedoms, not to mention how can we juxtapose presuming someone innocent and simultaneously stripping him naked and marching him past a national news network camera. I fear for our country. David Cole.
Well, I don't think that martial law was declared. The troops weren't out in Boston. What was said was that in the interest of everybody's safety, people should stay indoors and not go outside, which was a completely reasonable request on the part of the mayor. I don't think if someone were stupid enough to go outside, they weren't going to get arrested or the military wasn't going to pick them up. So I think that's an overstatement. With respect to his innocence, he is innocent until proven guilty. There's a lot of evidence already out there that suggests very strongly that he's guilty, but he will be, when tried, presumed innocent until proven guilty, which simply means that the government bears the burden of putting the evidence on the table.
And how does the fact that he is a U.S. citizen bear on their approach?
I don't think it should bear very much at all. All people within the United States, whether they're citizens, whether they're foreign nationals, whether they're here legally or illegally, have all the basic constitutional rights that are associated with the criminal process. So if it was Tamerlan, who was a foreign national, as opposed to Jahar, he would have had all the same rights in a criminal process. The one thing with respect to a foreign national is that you have greater authority to use. You can use the immigration process against him. You can deport him. But, you know, in a case like this, you're not interested in deporting. You're interested in bringing the person to justice within the criminal justice system, and that's the same rights apply regardless of the individual.
One further point, the older brother had been denied citizenship, or at least had it postponed, on the basis of concerns that the FBI had, Tom Jelton.
Yeah, what I understand is that after this exchange of communication with the Russian government that alerted the FBI to concerns about Tamerlan, his citizenship request was not denied, but sort of made subject to further review.
So was that after the trip, the most recent trip to Russia?
I don't know the chronology of that.
My understanding of the sequence is a little different, and I'm not saying one of us is right, one of us is wrong. I think this is stuff that's all going to get a little fleshed out as we go. But my understanding is he applies for citizenship in September of last year. And yes, they were looking at these two issues, not just the Russian trip, though. Also, he has an assault arrest. In the immigration process, that's an important thing that can be a hitch for people seeking citizenship. So anyway, he applies in September. And he hasn't gotten an answer yet. He just hasn't been told whether he's going to be a citizen or not, is what I was told. And frankly, in a major eastern seaboard city, having a wait of 7 to 8 months for a reply to that is not unusual. I mean, it's perfectly normal for that process to take a year or more. So I'm definitely saying the notion is wrong that he was denied citizenship. I think they were looking at it. It's not clear to me that it actually had delayed anything at that point. They were still in the process. They hadn't made a decision.
And his younger brother was granted citizenship on September 11th last year.
I think what's interesting about this is the profiles of the two individuals, because Tamerlan falls right into a very typical profile for what we're seeing. And we look at the radicalization, the trips. There's still a lot of information to come out, but it is not atypical. What is perplexing in this is the younger brother, because here's an individual, 19, who is well integrated in his high school, in his college, had lots of friends.
But not doing very well in college.
No. And then does the bombing and then integrates immediately right back into his life. He's tweeting. He is at a party, apparently, an intramural soccer party. He's going to the gym, while some say maybe he seemed more quiet. But he has conversations about the bombing as if he were anybody. And there is a psychosis and psychology to him that I think is really important to uncover, because it's quite frankly, it's flooring that he just walked right back
into. Kirsten makes a really good point here, and I think this is an area where it may actually be most helpful to talk to criminal profilers as opposed to terrorist experts, because what criminal profiles look at a lot is people who commit crimes in unison often have an interesting personal chemistry whereby on their own, neither of them would do the thing that they do together. And I think if you look at the two of them, there's some initial tangential evidence to suggest that the older brother did not have his life together to the point where he could have coordinated and organized this sort of thing. And the younger brother did not have the anger, at least to the degree that we've seen publicly expressed by the older brother, to pick a target like that or act out like that. Look, it's early. This could change. But I think what leaps out to me is that there is a criminal profile that needs to be done of these two. And we may end up reach a point where we say that neither of these guys would have done it on their own, but together they were a very, very dangerous combination.
David Cole, will the federal officials try him in federal court, or will he be tried in Massachusetts court?
I suspect he'll be charged in both. That is, he'll be charged under Massachusetts law with murder and a variety of other crimes under Massachusetts law. And he'll probably also be charged under federal terrorism law for using a bomb on a public in a public place. And he could be tried in both places. The principal difference between the two is that Massachusetts does not recognize the death penalty. Federal law does, and so federal prosecution could lead to the death penalty, whereas a state prosecution could not.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kirsten Todd, you were part of the White House during the Clinton administration. You were responsible for drafting key components of the legislation that created the Department of Homeland Security. What are the implications here for sporting events? How in the world do you see federal, local officials looking at these differently?
Well, there are two types of sporting events that we deal with. There are open events like a marathon or the Olympics, and then there are closed events. And the security around closed events can be easier because you can control access and egress. You can check everybody who's coming through. Open events are much more challenging. And if you look at the London Olympics, two things that they did at the London Olympics were to integrate resiliency into their infrastructure. So evacuation routes were overlapped with access to and from Olympic sites. Additionally, they had put up triage tents all throughout the city just as a precaution, as an infrastructure precaution. But to go back to 9/11 and to today and to look at sporting events, the key really is resiliency. When we were drafting the Department of Homeland Security legislation, in that immediate moment, it was how do we prevent something like this from ever happening again? But that dialogue shifted and it evolved to say, you know what, we're never going to be ahead of everything. We can't prevent everything. But what we can do is ensure that when something does happen, we can contain it and respond and recover as quickly as possible. And when we look at these types of events, we can make the efforts, the appropriate efforts, to prevent something from happening. But we have to put an infrastructure in place to ensure that if something does, when it does, we are there to make sure that it does as the least amount of damage as possible. And as tragic as Boston was, it actually had a lot of elements to it that made it much less tragic than it could have been. You had the best hospitals in the world yards away. You had an unbelievable police presence, 1,000 around. And you also had triage tents that were ready to handle thousands of runners available to help people. And those lessons, as well as looking at some of the more security issues, such as cameras and things like that, are ones from which we can learn for future security events.
Tom.
Well, it's not just events. It's not just sporting events. It's not just concerts. I mean, you have the soft target, potential soft target list is much broader than that. I mean, remember there was an attempt at a bomb in Times Square. That would have been a soft target with many more people involved. You've got shopping centers all over the country. I mean, you've got movie theaters. The number of soft targets that can't be protected, I think, is probably greater than the number that can be.
You might say life is an open event. You know, we can't possibly live in a risk-free environment in a public, in an open public society.
David Cole of Georgetown University. Short break here. When we come back, your calls, comments, questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By The Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
A new novel about a group of teens who meet at summer camp. It traces their decades-long friendship and the unpredictability of early talent. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. Let's go to Huntingtown, Maryland. Good morning, Joey. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
One of your guests mentioned that the older brother became more religious while visiting his mother, implying that simply being religious will or could lead to terrorism. We don't really know anything about his motives yet, so I'd like to caution against making assumptions. We already stigmatize the Muslim faith, so I'd like to ask your speakers to use more specific language with regards to radicalization and not generalize. Thank
you. It was actually I who said that, and I take your point. Any comments?
Well, I think it's a good point. I think, you know, becoming religious isn't itself a suspicious activity. I think the real question is, and this is where you see some of the witnesses who have spoken to Tamerlan in his life, where they sort of draw a dividing line. They say, yes, he was increasingly strident about religion. He would have what you could call arguments or emotional debates about religion within the local mosque he sometimes visited. But he never said anything indicating that we should then go and do something about it, or someone should pay a price for that, or there should be pain inflicted in any way. And that's how they describe those conversations. I think we're all trying to figure out what was going on in his head in the year or more before this event.
To Lee, New Hampshire. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I'm sure you know that the conspiracy people have been having a field day with this unfortunate event. You know, they're already labeling it as a false flag attack. The thing that disturbs me, though, is that the FBI has a history of signaling out individuals who they think might be led down the garden path and provide them with information and direct them in a way to conduct an attack, even though they give them, say, dud bombs and all that kind of stuff. But I'm sure people are going to seize on this and wonder if the FBI, having gotten the older brother on their radar, might have been tempted to see if they could manipulate him in some way. I'm not saying they did, but I'm saying this is a question that's going to come up.
David Cole.
Well, the use of informants to try to identify potential terrorist threats and stop them before the bomb goes off is one of the methods that the government has used, and in some cases quite successfully. In other cases, it seems like they may have entrapped individuals, but they can't possibly use informants against every individual who comes up on their radar screen in the kind of way that Tamerlan did. I mean, it's a very expensive kind of tactic. It's a tactic that has dramatic costs on the community, because if you're in a community in which the government is sending informants, you can't trust anybody in that community. So it's a tactic that is valuable but should be used sparingly. And I don't think any indication that it would have been appropriate to use it here.
Yeah, Bob is referring to these various sting operations that have been employed in the past. And as David says, I think that the consensus is that these actually have been successful and may even explain why, you know, possible terrorist threats have been diffused in the past. One of the things about those sting operations is that they have come at a moment in the planning of an operation where the wannabes realize they need help. And they're reaching out for help. They're looking for, like, more weapons, more technical assistance or something. And in the process of reaching out, they become vulnerable to a sting operation. What distinguishes this is this was such a homemade, or appears to be such a homemade operation, that they really didn't need to reach out, apparently, to anybody. And that would have made it much more difficult to intercept with some kind of sting operation.
Kirsten.
It is definitely seems like it's not requiring a lot of assistance. But what's important is, while we've used words such as these bombs were unsophisticated and things like that, the point is it's not easy to make a bomb. And you don't do it. This isn't luck that you get it right on the first time. And so I think what's important to understand is really to understand how were they trained? Where did they learn this? Did they practice it at some point? Because as basic as we've identified these bombs, they're still challenging. They're still challenging to make and to be successful. And they had to have had, by all accounts, some kind of support, training, education. And by whom and from whom, I think, are the critical questions to answer.
Devlin, on another aspect, how is the discussion on immigration likely to be affected?
It's an interesting issue, because these brothers were legal immigrants. They had been granted asylum and one was given citizenship. I think the obvious questions to ask, based on what we know now, is do people who travel back to let's say, difficult regions of the world, do we need to put even more scrutiny on them, though they are not illegal citizens? I mean, I think there is a separate conversation going on in Congress right now as to what to do with the 11 million people who aren't here legally. I think in some ways this doesn't really pair up very well with that, other than to create a more general anxiety about immigrants overall.
Huh.
You know, it was none other than President Obama himself who sort of alluded to that issue on Friday night when he raised this question without answering it. How is it that someone who was educated in American schools and in our communities would turn to such violence? That's the sort of the troubling question out there.
But you can ask that question about the various mass shootings as well. It's not something that's limited to immigrants or in any way particular to immigrants. These kinds of violent actions can be taken by anyone. So
that's
it
right.
shouldn't have an effect on the immigration debate.
To Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, John.
Good morning. We are part of the Cambridge community, and I think, you know, a lot of the discussion that revolves around is this criminal, is this terrorist, I think is significant in terms of, as we as a community see this as, you know, this individual, Jahar, and his brother, they are not others. They are us. They are Americans, or Jahar is an American. He's part of our community, which then we own just how difficult it is to try and wrap our minds around this, to understand, you know, the horror and the criminality and the loss of life to families who are in our community just across the river in Boston. And I think it's really significant for us as a country to embrace the idea that these are not others. You know, these are human beings just as we are. And I think that by taking that tact, we will be more successfully ultimately in trying to understand and how to protect ourselves and how to, you know, keep embracing what the American ideal is, and that is the diversity of our community and welcoming people to our country.
David.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And the real risk is that so often we don't respond as John has suggested we should, and instead we look for us, them. We try to say they're different from us, and that's the only way you can explain it. I think back to the assassination of President McKinley, and it was done by someone with a foreign-sounding last name who was an American citizen. And how do we respond? We responded by enacting very restrictive immigration laws. That's the way we typically respond. I think the way John suggested is the much more appropriate and resilient way to respond as a society.
All right. To Syracuse, New York. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question of a lot of innocent people that get put on the no-fly list, yet here is somebody, the older brother that FBI had been looking into, and yet he's still allowed to fly freely. I wonder if your guests had any comment on that, as well as his parents left to go to Chechnya and essentially kind of abandoned the younger brother, and the younger brother kind of seemed like he came under the wing of the older brother and relied on him.
Yeah, there's two points there. One, yes, it does seem that this family was fracturing or had fractured by the time this happened, meaning that the father had gone back, the mother had gone back, and at the same time, the mother and father split up. And that's certainly not an excuse or rationale for anything, but it does seem interesting to me that what's going on in these guys' lives at the time is that they are basically back here and their parents are gone, and they do not seem to be having a very good time. To the first question, I think, was about the issue of no-fly lists. And the no-fly list has always been, and frankly will probably always be, a very imperfect tool, because they scoop up a lot of data and they try and parse through the data, and you know, they have this list of derogatory information, they call it, and they try, if they build up a certain amount of derogatory information, they decide, okay, that person's on the list. And then you have to worry about, well, does their name just like another name? And when you're dealing with a lot of foreign names, frankly, it gets confusing, and you're transliterating a lot of things, which is also a problem. And I don't see any easy fix for the no-fly list. I think a no-fly list makes sense in a lot of ways, but there are always going to be problems with it.
Tom Chilton, could the Boston Marathon bombing have any effect on the choice of a new FBI leader when Robert Mueller retires in September?
That's a good question. You really need to put that to someone who really follows the ins and outs of Washington politics. One of the leading candidates for that position is Lisa Monaco, who came from the FBI and is now in the White House, having replaced John Brennan as the president's top counterterrorism advisor. And, you know, there has been enough criticism of the FBI for failing to, in the viewpoint of some of the Republican critics, for failing to take proper action after this Russian warning, that you can bet that if she or anybody else comes up for that FBI director's position, there's going to be some very tough questions asked about that.
And a lot of those questions are going to be questions that come up, frankly, for the first time in the context of a new FBI director. People tend to forget that when Mueller was given that job, it was just before 9/11. We have not had an FBI confirmation process in the what some people call the age of terror. And I think what's going to be difficult about whoever they pick is that they're going to have to answer a host of hypothetical situations and speak to a whole bunch of different constituencies who feel completely differently about how this process should work.
To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning, Diane and guests. Thank you so much for calling, taking my call. I was wondering if I'm the only one who wonders why the parents have not come to the United States to visit their ailing son and to see the remains, if they could, of their deceased son.
Of course, we can't get inside people's heads, but Tom.
Well, we do know that their father is apparently terminally ill and actually had gone back to Dagestan to die.
Are hearing reports that he plans to come here on Wednesday.
Right. That's what I'd heard in the last couple of days, that now that this happened, he did plan to come back. And I think he said something like he wanted to tell his son to cooperate or something like that.
Yes, and that can be an important part of this process, because if you remember back again to the underwear bomber case, that man's father came back and helped convince him to talk to authorities for a number of days, which proved very important. Now, he eventually shut down and stopped cooperating again at some point. But the father, in past cases, the father has proven very important in terms of gathering more information.
Interesting. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Ted.
Good morning, Diane. I had a comment about the younger of the two brothers and how shocked we are as Americans in this country that people come to this country, they're given the opportunity for our education, to work hard. They mix and mingle with students in school, and they just seem on all, you know, fronts normal. And what this all brings me back to is what happened in 9/11 when all the suspects all the people who committed that crime, all the Saudis, afterward, people were talking about how they just seemed like normal people. They were out partying with them. They walked through the airport completely normal. And what this younger brother brings me in the mind of is, I think part of the training for some of these people is to get into our culture and to be normal as they can be, with a goal in mind to take out as many of us as they can.
Yeah, and so when he came here as an 8-year-old, his goal was to act normally for 10 years. And then, no, I think this is somebody, we don't know why he did what he did. We don't know why many criminals do what they do. Many criminals seem normal from the outside. But the notion that this was some kind of act that a preteen and then teenager put on for 10 years, I think there's no basis for
Kirsten.
That.
Which I think goes to Devlin's earlier point about a criminal profile. And what we have to be careful in a situation like this is that we don't take one element of the case and project out on it. So we don't make this an immigration debate. We don't make it an Islam debate. We don't make it all of these different elements to the debate and focus on that by itself. We have to collect and aggregate the data to ensure that we're looking at this from a holistic perspective to make the right choices.
Kirsten, what changes do you see taking place in Homeland Security generally as a result of what happened?
Well, I think the point that we discussed earlier about the nomination of the FBI director, clearly we're going to need to understand what happened from the FBI's perspective. And I think, as we talked about earlier, looking at how we counter violent extremism, which is a Homeland Security component, DHS has a very strong role in that, and how we look at other countries and partners, and those countries which are not our partners, but we need to be working with, and how we work with them in the future. Domestically, we look at community resiliency response. I think we also want to be looking at how we are developing urban resilient infrastructures. I mean, the point was made that we have a lot of soft targets. And again, it's not about living in a state of paranoia. It's a state of awareness. And what can we do to encourage that awareness across the country?
I also think, I also expect that what will be a major result of this is there will just be a lot more cameras on the street. And that has been a debate in terms of, is that too intrusive? Is that too Big Brother-esque? I actually think, for better or worse, this attack is going to put a lot more cameras on the street and a lot more ability to just track things in real time in public space.
I agree with that. I think it's going to be a very powerful motivator for cities and governments to adopt these technologies of surveillance. But we also, I think, have to recognize that they can be misused and abused, and they need to be constrained by clear rules and regulations.
Last word, Tom.
Yeah, I just think in many respects, I think this bombing will turn out to be a kind of a game changer on a number of fronts, I'm afraid.
Tom Gelton of NPR, David Cole of Georgetown University, Kirsten Todd of Liberty Group Ventures, Devlin Barrett of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.